Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the NDP, official opposition, tries to get the Ford government to take the tolls off Highway 407 for truckers.
Has the province made peace with all of the teachers' unions? The government has landed an agreement with the English Catholic Teachers Union, ensuring the school year won't be disrupted.
And in our weekly Your Column, My Column feature, I'll look back at the life and times of Brian Mulroney, his relationship with three Ontario premiers when he was prime minister, and the loss of all three political titans from those historic elections of the 1980s.
And I will focus on something completely different.
It is Friday, March the 8th, 2024, so let's get to it. Okay, partner, first of all, a couple of things off the top here. Yes, my throat is terrible tonight, as you can probably hear. I was at the Leaf game the other day, and it was 1-1 going into overtime, and Austin Matthews, of course, he's truly amazing. He is truly, do you know who I'm talking about, first of all?
He is a hockey player.
Oh, my goodness. I have so much work to do with you, but yes, Austin Matthews, who is the greatest goal scorer of this generation, popped one in overtime, and I guess I overdid it. And anyway, so I'm not going to sound too good for
this. This is why I don't do live sports, because I got to keep the voice fresh for the one podcast a week I do.
Very good. Now, second thing, I see you are sporting a different shirt this week, and
yes.
Back in my day, we had nine planets. So this is a reference to
the former unjustly maligned planet of Pluto. Those of us who watched this drama unfold over, it took, I think, most of a decade. But Pluto was stripped of its title as a planet. But I guess in this case, I'm insisting on the old orthodoxy.
Do you know what I found very funny about that shirt was not the part that you found funny, but I always find it amusing when someone as young as you says, back in my day, did you have a day?
Well, I mean, you know, we're going to be talking about the 1980s a lot. And, I was born in 81 and a lot of my early memories of the 1980s. And so, yeah, I think of myself as like an 80s and 90s kid. Old enough to remember the sound of a dial-up modem. That's what distinguishes me from, let's say, some of our younger colleagues who are coming up behind me, young, talented people. And I just see them in the rear view and I'm realizing, oh, gosh, my day is coming.
You know, we call people like that? Whippersnappers, young whippersnappers. That's what I call them. I'm going to point to something on my shirt. Do you actually know what that is?
That would be the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
Correct. How do you know that?
Well, I have been hosting a podcast with you for the last several years.
He can be taught. All right, that's great.
By osmosis, if nothing else.
I know football season is still 4 months away, but I'm getting ready, okay? I'm getting ready.
Absolutely.
Anyway, shall we do it?
Let's get to it.
On to issue one. Okay, here's the situation. Highway 401 across the middle of the Greater Toronto Area is used by truckers a lot. Highway 407 across the top of the GTA isn't used by truckers very much at all because it is a toll highway. Costs too much to use. So the official opposition, you Democrats, thought, why not take the tolls off the 407 for truckers? It would presumably ease up on the congestion on the 401 and encourage greater use of the 407, which is quite underutilized. NDP leader Marit Stiles saying the premier is too afraid of the private operator of the 407 to do it. Doug Ford, to say the least, disagrees.
So back to the premier, when are you going to start prioritizing the interests of Ontarians instead of big corporations?
Speaker, let me get this right. You're against the 412 and 418. You voted against getting rid of the tolls. You voted against the 413. You voted against the Bradford bypass. You voted against the largest transit expansion in North America. But, like, which way are you going today? Are you going one way? Are you going the other way?
Ah, yes, a little bit of the exchange from the House this past week. Now, the official opposition indicate that they have done a study by a group called Environmental Defense, which says if we did what the NDP are suggesting, it would obviate the need to build that Highway 413 at a cost of $6 billion. It would avoid damaging the Greenbelt. It would save truckers 80 minutes of travel time through the GTA. So, Add all that up, and I'm going to ask you a question I already know the answer to. You think the premier is considering changing his mind on this?
We know that he is not, at least not right now, because the Tories, the majority in the legislature, did vote against the NDP motion and sent it to purgatory.
Is there a reason that they oppose the NDP motion other than it's a motion put forward by the NDP?
Well, I said this last week that, this idea keeps being proposed as an alternative to building the 413 highway. This would go across the sort of the northwest of the GTA, I guess. And this government is not looking for an alternative to build the 413. They want to build the 413. So they just want to keep going ahead with that. I do think it's fair to say that there's a bit of an inconsistent attitude, let's say, towards tolls with this government, where, they went through this big song and dance about prohibiting new tolls on publicly owned highways. But they are not considering a measure like this, which is a real tangible thing that the government could do at the cost of some money, and we'll get into that. But it is a tangible thing they could do to affect congestion and potentially improve people's lives pretty quickly.
Well, that's what I wondered, because you could be in favor of building the 413 and still do this anyway, because after all, it's going to take a decade to build the 413, right? It's not going to be around for a while. And traffic, presumably, on the 401 is only going to get worse between now and when the 413 is ready. So is there any way that the province could be better utilizing the 407 in the interim?
Well, that's part of the appeal of this whole idea, is that you could actually implement it relatively quickly. Maybe it couldn't be done instantaneously, but it seems like plausibly the kind of thing that you could get up and running in a year's time, let's say, whereas it will take something like a decade to build the 413. So you could do this faster. Environmental Defense argues that it would be cheaper to do so. They say $4 billion over 30 years, as opposed to somewhere between $6 to $10 billion to build the 413. But the government is, as we say, not like super interested in this idea. Worth noting here that the 407 is actually one of the most expensive toll highways on the continent. Its rates do continue to go up, and because it is privately operated, and the conditions of the lease that the province signed back more than 20 years ago, the province really doesn't have any kind of lever to pull in terms of lowering those rates.
Now, you went on the record last week with a position that will be extremely popular in the suburbs of the Greater Toronto Area. Namely, you're in favor of toll highways.
Yeah, I think that in general, we are not going to build, let's say, something analogous to like the DVP or the Gardiner in downtown Toronto again. The era of big highway building, at least certainly in the core of the region, is basically done. And I think we can sort of admit that. And so how do you handle congestion without trying to, do these massive new engineering projects? Well, toll roads are a tried and true method to do that. Even in places where they are expanding highways, and I think of like there are cities in Texas. Texas loves highways. Everything's bigger in Texas. But you see time and time again, like you add four lanes to a highway on the promise that it's going to save drivers 5 minutes in their commute.
Never does. A year later,
it's back to, or in fact, congestion can even get worse. I think that toll roads are a solution to congestion that actually works. And I think this is not an issue right now, but as we have more electric vehicles on the road, the government is going to be looking for some way to replace the gas tax. You already see lots of jurisdictions around North America trying to figure out what that's going to look like. Road tolls might be one answer.
That is a really good point. I had forgotten the notion that the governments everywhere depend on taxes from gasoline a lot. And if you've got a lot of EVs and a lot fewer people buying gas, you do have to replace that money somehow, don't you?
Yeah, one answer is no, you don't, right? Just let and this would be, I think, an answer that Doug Ford would be totally comfortable with. Right now, we don't have to replace the gas tax. Let the consumers keep that savings, and we'll figure out another way to bring that money in, right? Income taxes and sales taxes still work. But I think in general, governments kind of, certainly, let's say, bureaucrats in the finance ministry probably start to get hives when you say, when you talk about not replacing the gas tax.
There you go. Now, let us also state your dirty little secret. Well, dirty little not so secret for the record.
Yes.
You don't own a car, do you?
I don't. No.
You take transit and you bicycle everywhere.
Walk. I walk. I bike. I bike through most of the year. I did not bike a lot in December and January this year. But we're recording this in early March, and I biked to work today.
So people who drive cars for a living may not love your solution.
They might be
is what I'm trying to say.
Foaming at the mouth. it does seem self-interested. I grant. But I rent cars frequently. I have family who live all over different parts of the province, and we rent a car when we need to. I actually do enjoy driving once you get out of the city proper. So I'm sympathetic to the ideas that like driving is a lot of fun, but I'm not the ideal spokesperson for this idea.
I just can't wait for you to run for office in the north end of Etobicoke on the platform of bicycles for all, and we're going to toll all your roads.
Oh yeah, no, there's a reason I will never hold elected office. All of my views are politically unpopular.
Now, let us just, before we leave this subject, give credit where it's due, because it was the leader of the Green Party, Mike Schreiner, who was the first to float this idea almost 2 years ago. Didn't go anywhere then, may not go anywhere this time, because of course, the Ford government does seem determined to build 413. But let's take a second and talk about the politics of all this, because I found it fascinating that the government, I think in a very real respect, got itself outflanked by the NDP on the issue of consumer choice and affordability. And if we know this premier, we know those are issues that are near and dear to his heart. And my suspicion is, and I got nothing to hang my hat on here other than just suspicion, had he announced this idea, it would have been consistent with his brand, and I could imagine him, you know, beating the drum for this. I can imagine he would like this a lot. And yet, the politics of it seems to me he got outflanked by the NDP on it.
Yeah, and so, you ask, like, why isn't the government embracing this kind of a notion? And to go back to the cost, right, like, it would be a substantial cost, right? The environmental defense analysis looked at, I think, in the range of $260 million a year. And I think there's reason to think that number might even be conservative, that it could potentially be more than that. And governments are funny, in some ways, if they talk about spending like $1 billion in one big lump sum versus a few hundred million a year for 10 years.
Right.
They'll be more nervous about the smaller expense over a longer period of time, right? It's the ongoing expenses that make, again, those bureaucrats in the finance ministry, it's those ongoing perpetual expenses that make them nervous. So I think that would be one reason, because of course, the other issue that is sort of in the background of everything this government does, and you know, this has been a very common story over the last few decades, is just trying to balance the budget. This premier and his finance minister, Peter Bethlenfalvy, would very much like to balance the budget before the next election. And adding even a few hundred million dollars a year in new ongoing expenses, potentially for decades to come, that makes that idea of balancing the budget harder to get to.
And they announced budget day just yesterday, right?
Yes.
March 26th is going to be budget day.
Tuesday, March 26th. Right. So I imagine you'll be covering that intensely on the agenda.
We will both be doing something on that.
And then you and I will be discussing it on the podcast later that week.
Good stuff. Okay, on to issue two. This week, Education Minister Stephen Lecce announced the province has a tentative agreement with the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association. The teachers will have a chance to ratify, or not, on March 26. If they do, it means the government will have successfully achieved labor peace with all of the teacher unions. Okay, JMM, how big a deal is that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a big deal that it's a big deal for any government when they secure this kind of labor peace among the education sector. Potentially the most disruptive thing that can really derail a government's agenda is a big teacher strike. So when you get to avoid that, I imagine there's a lot of people breathing a sigh of relief in the premier's office. But of course, the process has not been without controversy, I think we could say.
You are quite right about that. Do you want to take us through some of the controversies along the way?
Well, so, I mean, I think you have to go back to Bill 124, which this government introduced in its first mandate. It was, in fact, Peter Bethlenfalvy before he was Minister of Finance. Finance introduced this bill that constrained the growth of public sector compensation. I think, as we always do say when we talk about this bill, that it did affect those of us here at TVO, and we're just going to concede that and keep on moving. Mm-hmm. You know, that was obviously extremely controversial. It was eventually ruled unconstitutional by the courts, and the government has decided not to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court. So they've accepted the judgment of the Ontario Court of Appeal that it was unconstitutional. That is going to have some knock-on effects in terms of the government's finances. They will probably end up paying retroactive pay to some unions to make up for the wages that were lost due to Bill 124. It seems like wild that this was like 18 months ago, but of course the government also briefly invoked the notwithstanding clause to try and prohibit strikes by the teachers' unions. That was a huge controversy. The government eventually backed down, repealed that bill that had threatened to use the notwithstanding clause. And then just as another little legal factoid, they declared that the labor dispute that had happened was never illegal, because you can retroactively declare things to not have happened when you're the parliament or the legislature. You know, and the unions were they had voted for strike mandates in many cases. So there was at least the real potential of some disruption during the school year here. And the fact that the government has extricated itself from these problems without getting a strike, without any massive disruption to the school year, as I say, people breathing a sigh of relief, I imagine.
Indeed. Now, I imagine some of you are asking yourself, has this ever happened before, where we got labor peace with all of the different teacher unions all at the same time? And the answer is yes. This is not unprecedented, but it has not happened in a long time. The last time labor peace broke out was in 2008. Premier Dalton McGuinty was in charge. His government successfully bargained with all of the teacher unions. And I think some of us who follow this stuff will remember that the Minister of Education at the time was...
Was Kathleen Wynne.
Kathleen Wynne. Yes. There you go.
You know, this is a recurring story in Ontario politics. You know, as education has become more and more central to what the provincial government does, right? We're no longer in the, you know, early 1900s when education was like just a purely local matter handled by school boards, right? It really has risen to a central focus in provincial government. And so, you know, you go back to the 1970s when I was in elementary school in the 1980s, and then of course, during the Harris years of the 1990s, right?
Days of action.
Yeah, exactly. Labor disputes in the education sector. I mean, I don't think I had a single school year that wasn't disrupted, at least somewhat, between, you know, grade 9 and I was one of the last years to have OAC, or grade 13, right?
You probably did not enjoy the fact that your school year was disrupted, but I think most kids probably were.
I mean, I found other things to do.
Okay. All right, good.
You know, I do find myself wondering if this is also at least a little bit of like a COVID hangover, right? I actually have not asked any of the union leaders this question, and maybe I should, but I find myself wondering if they were really confident that after 2021 and a bit of 2022, when schools were, you know, shut down briefly, how much support they think they would have had among Ontario's parents if a strike had shut down schools for a lengthy period of time. You know, maybe they would have had a lot of support. I think there is some sympathy to teachers just generally in the public, but I think it's a question worth asking.
Indeed. Very fair point. The other thing that is new here is that the government managed to get these agreements in large measure because they punted the toughest issue, namely wages. And they punted that off to binding arbitration. Now, most governments, of course, like to avoid binding arbitration because they always fear that the arbitrator is going to be too generous with the union in question, and governments don't want to be too generous in the money they have to pay out in salaries and wages and so on. For some reason, this government has embraced binding arbitration as a way to resolve these disputes. Any idea why Minister of Education Stephen Lecce has been open to going to binding arbitration in the case of the teacher unions here, but not necessarily with any other unions?
Well, I mean, there's a few different possibilities. One is that they have a better sense inside cabinet of what the government's finances are than necessarily us mere mortals on the outside. And they might feel like they've got a little bit more room to maneuver in terms of teachers' compensation than they did even a year or two ago. You know, the economy is recovering reasonably well from COVID, and there's been a lot of job growth and some income growth. And they, you know, the government may simply feel like, you know what, if we, you know, when you're talking about the education ministry, right? Like even small changes in teachers' compensation can be billion-dollar bills.
For sure.
But they might feel like they've got the room for that in the budget. We do know that the Financial Accountability Officer has just issued a report recently where they talked about the government has socked away a bit more money in some of its contingency funds, that we don't have a explicit explanation for yet. So that might be the kind of thing that where it might be that combined with the need to probably pay some retroactive pay for Bill 124, that might explain some of it.
I think we'll find all that out on the 26th of March.
I think we might.
I think we might. Okay, on to your column, my column. Okay, it's time now for a regular feature that we call Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I reminisce about the columns that we wrote for the TVO website, tvo.org, over the past week. Go ahead, start us off. What have you got up your sleeve?
So both of my columns this week are kind of dull affairs about really wonky matters of housing policy.
Are you supposed to admit that?
Well, you know,
it is on brand for you.
It is what it is. And like I could go on about, you know, the policies of like, how do we finance sewer construction? But I did that on the website and people can read that. So instead, I'm going to do something different here. Okay. We are going to return to something we used to do quite a bit more, which was quotes of note. And I'm going to take a clip from the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry, Perry Sound Muskoka MPP, Graydon Smith. Let's have a listen.
We will be remorseless in our sorry, in our blah blah blah. Some days you got it, and some days you don't. But we will not stop in our efforts to get this mill open.
You know— Okay, first of all, you got to hand it to him. You know, he was just having one of those days. He's normally very good on his feet during question period. But you know, as you and I both know, some days your tongue doesn't work and you just can't get the words out. And he had one of those moments.
Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, when you're speaking live to a camera and the Hansard, you don't get to edit your flubs out. So we're absolutely not dunking on the minister in this case. You know, it happens to the best of them. But it's an interesting moment. And I thought it was worth just explaining some of the context here, because the minister was responding to a question from the official opposition about a pulp mill in Terrace Bay, which is a community on the north shore of Lake Superior, about 250 kilometers northeast of Thunder Bay. And that mill has been closed, perhaps temporarily, but the union and the New Democrats were at Queen's Park earlier this week, earlier that day. They were really raising a concern about whether that mill is going to reopen. They say they've had no real communications with the ownership of the mill. And, you know, obviously we like to, when we can, cast our view around the province to communities that don't necessarily get a ton of attention. And, you know, this has been an issue we've seen. I wouldn't say it's been super common, but we've seen it a few times in the last few years where, in some cases, these are mills that got substantial government funding for things like refits or environmental sustainability grants from either the federal or provincial or sometimes both levels of government. And then they shut down and there's no accountability for, like, where did that public money go? Did it just get sent off to the shareholders of a foreign multinational? Or, you know, so that's a whole issue. And the other question, frankly, that we've seen in other communities, and I'm thinking, I think it was Iroquois Falls about a decade ago now, where the mill shut down and the owners of the mill effectively refused to let it reopen as a functioning mill. They sold it. They eventually sold it to the municipality, but it was on the condition that it could not be reopened as a pulp mill. So lots of really let's say, tumultuous times in the forestry sector. Obviously, this is a story that goes back a while. It's been kind of a rough few decades for the forestry sector in the North. But this was an issue. I mean, obviously, as I say, we're pegging it to a kind of a funny clip from Question Period, but it was an issue that I thought we could talk about a bit more.
Good stuff. Well, I had a couple of columns this past week about Brian Mulroney. For obvious reasons, we know Canada's 18th prime minister died last month, February 29th, actually, at the age of 84. Two different columns. The first one focused on Mr. Mulroney's relationship with the three premiers of Ontario that he mainly had dealings with during his time. That'd be Bill Davis, David Peterson, Bob Rae. Frank Miller was also premier during this time, but for such a short time, there wasn't really much to talk about there. The point was this. Yes, Mr. Davis and Mr. Mulroney got on very well, of course, because their brand of progressive conservatism was relatively similar. But it's also right to say that Mr. Mulroney got on very well with David Peterson, with whom he negotiated the Meech Lake Constitutional Agreement, and also with Bob Rae, with whom he negotiated the Charlottetown Accord. Two attempts at constitutional renewal, ultimately neither one enacted, but that's not to say it wasn't worth the effort. I also did another column last week on the fact that the three titans, we got Brian Mulroney, we got John Turner, we got Ed Broadbent, who fought two historic elections in 1984 and 1988 against one another. And with Mr. Mulroney's death, they're all gone right now. And it really felt like a kind of a, just like a real turning of the page of history right now to see these three titans who would go after each other hammer and tong in public, like absolutely brutal against each other, but behind the scenes actually quite admired, liked, and respected each other. And I'll give you just a couple of examples here. Brian Mulroney, after beating John Turner twice in the 84 and 88 elections, when Mr. Turner stepped down as Liberal leader, offered him the ambassadorship to both Italy and the Vatican. Mr. Turner was a staunch Catholic, and he would have really enjoyed those posts, and he would have represented Canada well, but he decided he wanted to go back to Bay Street, make some money. But the point is, Mr. Mulroney made the offer. And as Ed Broadbent stepped down around the same time as well as Mr. Turner, he was given the presidency of a group that was being created called Rights and Democracy, which was an attempt to export both around the world. And the gist, of course, that the column tries to make the point that it's one thing to go after each other in public, but behind the scenes, civility, respect, admiration, those are nice things. They had them then. I don't know if we have them today. I know we're going to go into the mailbag in just a moment, but I wanted to read this here because it is related to this subject. This is from a former member of the Ontario legislature named Jim Folds, who was the NDP member from Port Arthur from 1971 to 1987. I think his son Andrew actually is a member of the Thunder Bay City Council today. Anyway, another generation. Apropos of my column that the three titans of the 1980s elections are gone, Mr. Folds wrote the following. We fought just as fiercely, if not more so, at Queen's Park, and I have the scars to prove it. And I am proud of every one. But like professional athletes, we had respect and admiration for those opponents who deserved and earned it. And we concentrated on the issues. More importantly, we did not doubt 99.9% of our opponents were in politics to serve the public good. I think also we mostly had a sense of fun and humor about our craft, and about ourselves, and about our opponents, which helped to keep us balanced. When I think about politicians as different as Bill Davis, Darcy McHugh, Bob Nixon, Jimmy Auld, Bob Welsh, Floyd Logren, and Eli Martel, they all had this sense that they took their work seriously, but they didn't take themselves too seriously. That's from Jim Folds from Thunder Bay, and I really like that take on politics, so I thought I'd include it here.
Yeah, and you do still see glances of that at Queen's Park today, I would argue. There is still congeniality and collegiality, but I think it would be fair to say it's rarer than it used to be. One thing I will say, and I'm not inventing this, I'm drawing from work done by the Samara Center for Democracy. In the federal parliament, it does seem like that collegiality has almost entirely disappeared.
Right.
They've had reports where MPPs talk about not even feeling like they can have lunch with members from the other side of the aisle because members of their own party will, you know, whisper and ostracize them, you know, for you know, even just talking to the other side.
Which is nuts.
Which is nuts, absolutely nuts. And I don't think it's quite that bad at Queen's Park yet. I mean, even that moment that we played earlier with Graydon Smith, I mean, yeah, like I'm sure that in the moment, maybe the opposition parties might have been like pointing and laughing at him, but they've all been there. They've all had those on-camera fumbles. And after the camera was turned off, I'm sure some people, you know, said, hey, you know, don't worry about it, right?
I have no doubt. Let me do one last note about this issue, and that is, ironically enough, one of Mr. Mulroney's greatest rivalries was with the current prime minister's father, because it was Pierre Trudeau who repatriated the Constitution with an accompanying Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But because there was a separatist government in Quebec at the time, he did not get Quebec's signature on the agreement. Mr. Mulroney did achieve that with Meech and with Charlottetown, both of which died for other reasons, but Quebec did sign both of those agreements. And the expression we heard back in the day, as your shirt said, the expression we heard was, Brian Mulroney's going to finish the job that Pierre Trudeau started by getting Quebec's signature. Mr. Trudeau, on February 29th, 40 years ago, went for that famous walk in the snow and decided at that moment that he was going to retire from public life. And Mr. Mulroney, this year, on February 29th, died. For two men who really were great political rivals, the notion that they will share that extraordinary day, February 29th, which only comes along once every 4 years, I don't know. I find that intriguing.
Yeah, sometimes the stars align in just weird, weird ways. And with that, on to our mailbag.
If you've got a burning question or insightful comment, please send it along to us at this email address, onpolitics@tvo.org. JMM, what do we got to start this week?
Here's an email from a listener, Andrew Hunter, and a continuation of our discussion around the 407 highway. Andrew writes, hey, Steve and JMM, still faithfully listening to the podcast, so I'll have to check out the video to see your sartorial choices. Timely. Something worth noting is the road surface on the 407 was designed for heavy truck traffic, as are some of the new 401 sections near here, Ontario. Paying the tolls for trucks would increase the lifespan of the asphalt surface of 401 and on connecting municipal roads for trucks destined for the industrial land the 407 passes through. Mm. Win-win. Andrew Hunter in Ontario's capital city.
Well, that's interesting. What's he referring to there?
So the 407 has a more durable highway surface. Like most roads you've ever driven on in Ontario, the uppermost layer of the road is just asphalt, very common. But the 407 actually is topped with concrete, makes it much more durable. It lasts longer compared to asphalt. Maintenance costs can be higher, but you know it's a question of do you get what you pay for. Road engineers, I'm sure, geek out about this stuff. It does make it more difficult to repair in some cases. You have to like lift slabs of the highway out and replace it with concrete.
Do you know what I've noticed? And I'm not on the 407 a lot, but sometimes when I go to Hamilton, I take the 407. It's noisier. It's a lot noisier driving on the 407. And I don't mean the other traffic. I mean rubber hitting road is noisier on the 407 than the 401. Why would that be?
Well, so it's just the difference that the difference in the noise that the tires make rolling over concrete versus asphalt. The concrete actually has to be brushed a little bit to give it some texture. It would otherwise settle into a pattern that would be too slippery for road safety. So they add just a little bit of texture to the concrete in order to improve road safety. But a side effect of that is you do get a bit of noise.
Huh, never knew that. Okay, let's continue. Here's an email from a listener named Felix who asks, hi, Steve and JMM, do we know what the provincial cabinet committees are and what their membership is? A little searching does not yield any recent results, even for a statutory committee like the Treasury Board. Best, Felix. Okay, Felix, this is deep in the nerdy weeds of how governments work, but traditionally you got a cabinet and then a bunch of cabinet subcommittees, like priorities and planning is often one, social services, economic development, that kind of thing. Do we know what this particular government of Ontario has?
We know for sure that there are at least three cabinet committees because Ontario law requires that those committees be created and that the premier publish the membership of those committees. So that's the Management Board of Cabinet, Treasury Board, and the Cabinet Committee on Emergency Management. So there are Ontario laws that created those committees or at least require them to be created and require that the members be appointed by an order in council. The orders in council are public documents that you can look up in Ontario. They're not always published in a timely fashion, I will just say, as my gripe as a journalist, but they are published online and you can look them up. You know, different governments have taken, I would say, different attitudes towards how open they are about cabinet committees. I think under Kathleen Wynne, for example, it was more common for the government to be forthcoming about the membership of cabinet committees. With the current government, it's possible I missed it. I don't remember any press releases announcing the membership of cabinet committees. You just sort of have to root through the listings for the orders in council.
Gotcha. Let's finish up on this one here because it relates to something we talked about last week. Remember last week we talked about heritage properties and the difference between being listed, being designated for preservation. There were some different nuances there. And I mentioned at the time that I remember covering this story almost 40 years ago. There was a train station in the west end of Toronto that I thought had been designated for preservation, but CN Rail tore it down anyway because they wanted to do some different kind of development there. And I remember Mayor Art Eggleton showing up at the time and having a press conference decrying how the railway took down that historic station, seemingly against the wishes of the city. I got this note on that story. It says, "Hi, Steve. On one of your recent programs, I believe that you indicated that a designated heritage railway station in the city of Toronto had been demolished with no penalty to the demolisher. I was head of the Historical Preservation Division of the Toronto Historical Board before retirement many years ago. As I recall it, designation by bylaw under the Ontario Heritage Act is done by city councils passing a municipal bylaw. But municipal bylaws do not bind the Crown. And so it seems that railway properties, being federal, could not be designated. My recollection is that the railways demolished a station in the Junction area of Toronto, that's the one I went to, and also a station around King Street west of Dufferin. These properties were probably listed, i.e. included on the city's then inventory of heritage properties, so I don't think the city had the power to place a penalty on the demolisher of listed properties. Best wishes, Marcia Cuthbert," and she signs it Vic 59. So I guess she graduated from Victoria College at U of T in 1959. And that would explain why nobody was punished 40 plus years ago when those train stations were unilaterally demolished. So thank you, Marcia.
I want to put a spotlight on this because this is one of my favorite little topics. I have many. because, of course, planning powers, municipal planning powers, derive from provincial law. But the province cannot impose any kind of legislation in an area of federal jurisdiction. Mm. Railways are a matter of federal jurisdiction. So if CN wants to build a train station or knock down a train station, that's purely a federal matter, and municipal planning policies cannot apply. CN could choose to comply with a municipal planning policy, but there's actually, there has been a long-running issue. I think it's basically settled now because it went all the way to the Supreme Court, but out in Milton, I believe, CN wants to build a new train yard there on their rail line, and it conflicts with the planning policies of the local municipality, and I think the regional municipality as well. But CN is like, your laws don't apply to us, more or less, and they are 100% correct. It's the kind of thing that crops up.
You have a glint in your eye right now. You are so excited talking about this kind of stuff. It really turns you on, doesn't it?
Federalism and planning law, and who doesn't love a good story about trains? I mean, it's got everything.
Maybe, anyway. Okay. I was going to say something, but I'll take it back. Why don't you give the email address one more time, and then we'll get out of here.
If you would like to ask us about any of the content on the show, or just send in fun facts about trains, you can email us at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Very good. That is the On Poly podcast for this March the 8th, 2024.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And if you already follow our show, help a friend follow it too.
Let's give the email address one more time, because any feedback you've got, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. onpolitics@tvo.org is the special email address to reach us. Be sure to include your first and last name and what part of the province or world, for that matter, you're emailing from. Yeah.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara, video editing by Colin Kish.
Production support from Jonathan Hallowell, Christine Gardner, Arianna Longley, Vito Tagarelli, Jeff Cusera, and Jennifer DeRosa.
Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor. Lori Few is the executive producer of Digital. John Ferry is vice president, programming and content.
Special thanks, as always, to our wonderful crew here in the studio for making this video podcast happen. And until next Friday, everybody, bye-bye.
See you next week.